Hey, everybody. Man, the preaching must have been awesome last week to do this to the crowd. Last week started just a little two-part thing on justice, which I'm going to catch everybody up on or do a review because I think that's really important. Justice is something that we all care about because we want to see that justice done to us. We want to see justice in the world. We want to live in a world full of justice. But we can sometimes get off track. We can sometimes lose our way, and lose sight of what it was. And sometimes we can be running really hard towards something that we think is justice and find out that we've been running the wrong direction all along. Last week and this week, we're just dealing with two questions of what is justice and how do we pursue it. Justice is when God and people are in right relationship, and when people and people are all in right relationship, and then all of humanity is living in harmony with all of the created world. And just like last week, I want you to try to imagine that for just a second, what that would be like for people to be, everybody that you meet, everybody that is, to be completely at peace and completely whole and free of anxieties and depression and addictions and mental disorders, sort of things, and just completely whole and happy and full of joy and loving God and grateful for their life and complete life-giving relationships with all the people around them and living in complete harmony with all the created world. If you can imagine that, or even just a little piece of that, we are imagining justice. We are imagining the kingdom of God, the dream of God. And that's what we are called to pursue as Christians in our life. That is the calling of every Christian to find ways to minimize the suffering in the world and elevate justice and bring about justice. And that is right relationships. And it is grounded in the way that it flows is from God. That is where justice comes from. Justice, right relationships, comes from God. And a relationship to God where God reorients the things that we love and the things that we care about, our character, refines us, reforms us, sets us free, heals us from the inside out. And that begins to shape who we are, and that shapes the relationships that are around us. And it begins to affect all of the rest of the world around us. And God's doing that to individuals all over the world. And that's how the kingdom of God is growing and flourishing in the world. And the best person to look to figure out how to pursue justice is who? Jesus. Jesus. Come on. Sunday school answer, people. Jesus. The best person. Okay. All right. We got one person that said Jesus. Sheesh. I hope no one listens to this online from somewhere that's not our church. They know about Jesus, okay? And Jesus, he goes about pursuing justice differently than what we would, differently than what we intuitively think is the way to go. But the amazing thing is that he, living on earth, began his ministry and had 36 months to accomplish the healing of the world. You know, crazy, huge mission, short time frame. And the things that he did was prioritize, first of all, his relationship with God, with that first and foremost. That's how he spent the first 40 days. And then he began spending most of his time with a small group of people and investing that in that and spending most there and a lot of that avoiding crowds. And that is the biggest mission. This thing that Jesus started has been the biggest mission, the biggest movement to bring the most good of anybody that has ever walked the face of the earth. Most profound life to have ever lived, the most profound influence for the good was been Jesus in these 36 months of his life. And the cool thing about that is that you and I have, with Jesus in us, have the same roadmap and Jesus with us to live out that same sort of significance, that same calling and that same mission to pursue justice and right relationships in the world, the healing of the world. And that's how God is working that stuff out. Through you and through me, as God reforms our life and reforms what we love and what we dream of and what we grieve, that it begins to shape the world around us. I knowingly said some things that upset you, some people. And I don't do that, I don't say that lightheartedly or flippantly. Some of you thought it was all great. Some people, it upset. But I did that because I love you, and you can't, it's hard to talk about about justice without talking about race, without talking about politics. And it's tough in a group that's larger than two or three people to talk about race and politics without somebody getting upset, right? And if you weren't aware of that, then I would like to introduce you to 2019. we all have lots of, we care about these things. We have lots of stories. We have lots of feelings about this stuff. And we should. They shape and they affect our lives. But if there's a chance out there to jump in the water and make, and maybe things are messy, but then on the other side could be maybe something better, then I want to take that chance over every time than just staying on the shore and just not not taking the risk for better relationships and for justice in our own lives, you know. And had a bunch of really good conversations that came out of that this week. And if, I don't know if you've noticed, but I'm not Andy Stanley, so I'm pretty available to you. So if you would ever like to talk about anything, just let me know. So justice isn't easy stuff. Justice isn't easy stuff. Working out right relationships, it's not easy stuff. And I think maybe some of you last week, I think during the week, that had some conversations where we were working that stuff out. And I want you to know that, and I want you to feel that, because if you're going to do this work of justice, it's not easy. Justice and right relationships, it's not the default setting of the world. You don't just let go of the wheel and it just kind of like meanders towards everything being great, you know? That's just not how this stuff happens. It takes like gut-wrenching hard work. It takes being vulnerable. It takes being humble. It takes every ounce of wisdom that we can scrape together, every bit of humility, every bit of love, every bit of compassion, every bit of that stuff, and scraping together. It's going to be a mess, but maybe a mess that moves forward. It's hard work. It's difficult. It's not the default setting of the world. It's not what happens when you just let go. And in this messiness, our motives and our aspirations, our goals, they really matter. I told you last week that one of the things that I said was that a pretty committed to not have relationships with people of other races out of shame and out of guilt related to the color of my skin. And I told you in an email, I'll explain why, and I'll explain a bit of that. I think that I don't want to necessarily, but it illustrates that our motives matter. Our motives matter. So as an adult, I know now that my parents weren't good people. I didn't know that as a kid. I thought they were great. I thought they were wonderful. It's what most kids think of their parents. They think they're really great people. And there was a lot of like interesting things in my childhood, and I'll tell you just one piece of that. And I think of it today as a ritual. And the ritual went something like this: that everything was my fault and I was to blame for everything. And my dad would tell me to go to my room or go to his room, and I would beg and I would plead and say, "No, Daddy, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." And maybe it was something I did. Maybe it was just something bad that happened in the family. I didn't always know. And so I'd go to his room and maybe sit on the bed, maybe pace or whatever, and just trembling because I didn't want what was happening next or what was going to happen next. I didn't know like how to fix it or what I'd done. And sometimes he would come right away. Sometimes he would wait, because in that intentional waiting, it's a deliberate act of prolonging the suffering. And he would come in, my dad, and sometimes he would yell. Sometimes he was completely calm. Most of the time he was completely calm. And explain to me, like, that everything is my fault and I'm all to blame. Sometimes in his yelling, he would be face to face with me, or towering over me, or pushing me around, or driving his huge fingers into my little chest. And then at some point, you know, and I'm feeling so sorry for all of this, and I don't know what I've done, and I would, or maybe I know what I've done, but I would do anything to fix it, anything to change it. And he'd have me pick out a belt, and it didn't matter which one it was, whether it was thin or whether it was thick, result was always the same. And he would explain to me that, like, he didn't want to do this. And the fact that he was doing it, it was like I was making him. And that was still my fault. And so I was actually hurting him. And he would tell me that he was going to beat me until I couldn't stand up and I couldn't sit down. And he would. And I'd say, no, Daddy, I'm so sorry. And then laying on the floor, shaking, waves of pain. I didn't know that those things were a lie or what all was going on. I just believed it all because I'm a kid, right? So I believed that it was all my fault, and I'm praying out to God, God, fix me, because I'm just so messed up. I'm just so messed up that I deserve every bit of this, and I can't figure out how to get things right so that things will be okay. And that was just a part of my life. And it took a long time. That was part of the foundation of who I am in my formative years. And as God has pulled me up out of that hole, I don't have nightmares much anymore in the night or in the day. And God has brought a lot of healing into my life. And one of the things that I've taken out of that is that I'm pretty committed to not taking on guilt for things that I haven't done. And maybe that's not something that everybody needs, but maybe that's not the way for everybody, but it damn sure is my way. I try to guard myself from taking on guilt for things that I haven't done, and I try to guard myself, and I don't do it as well, of falling into the pit of shame for things that aren't true of me. So if that's something that maybe the world has taught you, or maybe you just made up yourself, I don't know, that you look at me and you think that what you need from me is shame and guilt because the color of my skin, I have nothing of that to offer you. I hope to God I have nothing of that to offer you. But I will love you, and I will grieve over the things that hurt you. I will grieve over the heartaches in your life. And I will celebrate with you the blessings that God has brought your way. You know, the jury is still out on whether shame and guilt can lead to right relationships, can lead to restored relationships in humanity, but love is pretty solid. Love is pretty solid. That's a pretty solid way to go. If shame and guilt is something that you're invested in and you think that that's a way forward. And some people did. Some people thought, you know, in my conversations this week, they thought these are the only two options. It's either white shame and guilt or racism. And I'm telling you, there's a way. It's that we love each other. It's that we love each other. Our motives matter. I've given the last 15 years of my energy, my financial potential, a lot of my well-being to be minister and friend to people of that are of a different race. Most of that has been in largely black communities, and people that are struggling at the bottom of life. And it has nothing to do with anything related to my skin. It has to do, or anything, I've never felt guilty or like I owed somebody something. But I did know that God loves those people, and this God that is my rescuer and my healer cares about broken relationships, cares about the broken places of the world, and that is what really lights God up, is to have his children walking into the broken places and singing peace and love and goodness. That's what makes my God, my healer, happy, the one that is healing me. That's why I've done what I've done. Our motives matter. Our motives matter. And if we follow the wrong motives, we won't get to the place that we want to go. And that's what Jesus is telling us in our text today. The background of this story is that he knows, like, he's walking around the world. He sees all the brokenness. He sees the persecution. He sees the suffering. It's not removed. He doesn't have to turn onto some channel. He doesn't have to, like, look behind the bushes or under an overpass or something like that. He sees it everywhere. He sees it everywhere. And it's and one of the wrong ideas we get about oppression and suffering and all that kind of stuff is that we think that it's just the top and the down, the top and the down, like there's just two different groups of people. When we think of Hitler, for example, we think like this was this man that like was evil and he bent this country full of good people to his will and then made them do evil, bad things. But that's not a proper understanding of humans. It's not a proper understanding of you, and it's not a proper understanding of me. Nazi Germany was full of little Hitlers, millions of them, that were following a messed up view of what a better world looks like. People that felt good off of the suffering of others, that felt good off of a sense of superiority, that felt good off of having a power dynamic with other people. Same thing with Stalin's Russia. An incredibly, masterfully evil man. But nobody would even know who that is if no one followed along. Soviet Russia was full of little Stalins, from the top to the bottom, people that felt good from taking from others, people that were prone to spite and to envy and to jealousy and hatred and malice and indifference, people that would let themselves be quieted by fear. And Jesus' world was that way. It was from Caesar all the way down to the moms and dads and shepherds and the schoolyard bully. Little Caesars, little Hitlers, little emissaries of oppression and injustice. That's how the world is. That's the world that Jesus saw. And the thing that people expected from the Messiah, the rescuer, they were looking for a rescuer, for a Messiah, for somebody to come and world right. Many Jews still are today, and their version of what that would look like today hasn't changed much from back then, and not everybody in the house of Judaism fits in the same categories, but the idea is that the Jewish people, the chosen people of God, would be lifted up and everybody else would be down. It's a very ethnocentric, race oriented view of things, and so they it's not a vision of equality. And Jesus, knowing this, that the Messiah was supposed to come and lift Israel up and push everybody else down and have the chosen people, the city on the hill, which that narrative played its own role in our history, right? So then in Luke chapter 6, our text, this Jesus, this Messiah, he starts talking about loving your enemies, loving your enemies. Everybody knows that that's not what you do with enemies. That's not what a Messiah certainly should know of all people, that love is not the thing that you do with enemies. What do you do with enemies? You hate them, right? You kill them. You silence them. You sweep them into the dustbin of history. At a minimum, you undermine them at work. You make them a social pariah. You make them an outcast, a symbol of shame and contempt. That is what you do with an enemy. You certainly don't love them. Because an enemy is a threat. And we want to put threats down and get rid of them. Move them off the map. That's how we push forward to a better world. We get rid of our enemies. But Jesus, the rescuer, the most profound change agent for good in the history of the world, is trying to cue us in on something. That the world that we want to live in, is never going to be attained running down the road of hate and contempt. We're never going to get there running down that road. The only way to get there is love. And it's hard, and sometimes, and just intuitively, it doesn't feel like the solution, right? When somebody has really hurt us, when somebody is a threat to us, intuitively, it does not feel like the solution. Violence, hate, contempt, wiping them out, that seems to be the solution. But Jesus is saying, we're not going to get where we want to go without love. That's the way to go. Jesus isn't dismissing the wrongness or the oppression of the world, the suffering of the world, but asking us to check our motives and find a different way. Our goal needs to not be getting rid of our enemy, but to making our enemy our friend. Isn't that what we want when we're wrong? Has anybody been wrong before in here? Everybody been wrong? Yeah. I've been wrong. And what we want when we've been wrong is that we want someone to bring us around to seeing things differently so that we can be right and say, oh my goodness, I've been wrong. I would like to start living towards what is true and good and noble. I would like to start living towards the good thing. And that's what Jesus is telling us in this text. He tells us to love our enemies, and then he gives some examples of what this looks like. Love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you and pray for those who mistreat you. Everybody's doing that at work, right? If someone slaps you on the cheek, turn the other cheek. What Jesus is starting to do is give examples in his cultural, historical context of what it looks like to turn things around with your enemy. Turning the other cheek doesn't mean if somebody's beating the snot out of you that you just keep on taking it. Meaning in that context is if somebody hits you, then respond to that in a way where they have to humanize you. They have to treat you as an equal. They can't hit you. They can't hit you as a servant. They have to hit you as a fellow equal, as a fellow person. And then he goes on and he says, if someone in a legal financial court, if someone takes your coat, which would be a debtor's court, do not withhold the shirt from them. So if you're taken, the economic system of the day was very oppressive to poor people, if you can imagine that. And in their debtor's court, they could sue even the very coat off of your back. And so what Jesus is telling them is take even your shirt off and bring shame to them. Let them see what they're doing. They feel so haughty and so I've gotten it over on these other people. And that culture, nakedness shamed the people that saw you. And so they saw that they were actually making less of themselves. I don't recommend you applying that directly today, going to court and taking your clothes off. It may not. You can't just say the Bible told me so. I don't think that's a direct implication of what Jesus is wanting here. He's telling if somebody tells you to, a Roman soldier basically tells you to carry their kit, legally they could make you carry their kit for a mile. After that, they were breaking the law. So if you carry it for that second mile, what's going to happen? They made you carry that for the first mile, and then you're happily carrying it along for that second mile, and they're trying to come after you and get you to stop, and it changes the whole dynamic. You have agency. You are a person. See me as a person. It's trying to figure out other ways to get your enemy to come onto the right, to the right side of seeing the rightness and wrongness of the situation and see the humanity in you. When we do our part of loving our neighbor, we are doing what we can, our enemy, we're doing what we can to bring them around to the right side of things. And it won't always work. Here's the deal. It's not always going to work. You're not always going to love somebody and that turn them around. But here's the promises that Jesus makes to us. That it may not save them, but it will save you. It'll keep your own soul from being darkened by hate, by malice, by contempt. And it will make you a truer son and daughter of God. The one who is good and kind to both the righteous and the unrighteous. It will make you like the God that we see in Jesus, who is wiping the poo off of Judas's feet, his friend who he knows is about to betray him, takes on the position of a servant, of a slave, the Son of God, the one that taught the stars to sing, wiping the poo off of his friend's feet that is about to betray him. When we love our enemies, there's no more time than when we are loving our enemies that we look more like this Jesus that is hanging on the cross, that is looking out at the people that have betrayed him and turned this innocent man over to torture and death, suffering. And he looks out at them and he says, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And when you find the courage and the strength to love your enemy, in that moment, you are a true son and daughter of God. You are living out the way of Jesus. Sometimes justice, pursuing justice and love doesn't change other people, but it's always going to change you. It's always going to change you, and that's worth something. It's worth a lot. So how are we doing with this, Christians? this out? Are we, you're doing that well? You're doing that well? Well, I should take notes from you then. Who are you angry at? Who are you angry at? Anger is not a bad emotion. It's an emotion that tells you that something's wrong or something needs to be protected. It's not a bad feeling. It's not a wrong feeling. But what you do with that is important. Who are you angry at? And how are you handling that? What are you doing with that? Maybe it's some jerk at work that's just awful. And maybe you need to figure out what their favorite drink is and bring it to them. Find some non-creepy ways to shower them with love and catch them off guard without violating any policies or making anything worse. Maybe it's somebody in your family. Maybe it's your spouse that things have gotten wonky with, that you're angry at, that you're bitter with. That you feel hurt by or disappointed in. And you need to reach out to the resources around you and figure out how to move forward towards the dream of God in that. If the one that you love has become enemy, then love your enemy. Maybe the thing that you need to do most to move towards right relationships with other people is set healthy boundaries. That's a pretty solid thing. That's a pretty solid thing in good relationships with people, is setting healthy boundaries. Maybe you don't do that very well. Maybe you set your healthy boundary in somebody else's yard, as we talk about sometimes. And maybe you set it way too far back and you just let other people run amok through your yard. And it makes you angry and bitter, but it's not their fault because you're not setting your boundaries well. Maybe the person that you're angry with the most is yourself. Maybe the person you're angry with the most is God. And you need to find another way, like Jesus says, find another way to move forward in love and in justice. This isn't just an individual thing, though. As God shapes the Christian heart, we begin to love what God loves, and we also begin to grieve what God grieves. And it opens our eyes to things that we may have thought was normal all of our life, and then all of a sudden we see it and we're like, this is wrong. This is wrong. I can't be okay with this. I need to do something about this. This is wrong. And you begin to grieve and dream for something different. Dream the things that God dreams. And it's not just in your individual relationships, but in the big things of the world, the wiring of the world. And it begins to bother you, and you want to do something about it. And that is exactly how God has been changing the world since Jesus. It works the same way that we've been talking about the big things, that God shapes our hearts and shapes our character and shapes who we are in the world. We begin to see things differently and treat people differently, and then our eyes are open to different things, and then there's stuff out there that bothers us, and that we just can't be content until things are different. And we're going to push forward in that, in the energy and the love of God, because there's a better world that we're dreaming of and leaning in, because God has put that in our heart. And that's the same way that God has done that in every big movement that has been good in the world, almost everyone that I can think of. In the 1800s, Elizabeth Fry, Jesus shaped her heart, and she began spending time in prisons. And she said, this is really messed up. We can do better. And she began the prison reformation movement in the Western world. Craig DeLoach, his heart was shaped by Jesus, and he picked up that baton, and he keeps running with it today in the prison reformation movement. It is shaped by a Jesus-shaped heart, led by that. Robert Raikes, God opened his eyes to the suffering of the children around him, and he started Sunday school classes. He started advocating for child labor laws. No one had done this before. Advocating for the rights of children. Aren't they just the property of their parents? William Wilberforce. God shaped his heart and took the incredible power of his resources and his powers of persuasion and led him to take the charge of seeing this thing of human slavery that had been normal for thousands and thousands of years in almost every culture across the globe and see that it's wrong and begin to do something about it. He says, this is a violation of the way of God. This is a violation of the heart of God. And began convincing people through his relationships that this is wrong. And it led this movement of abolition, of ending of legalized slavery in the Western world. Amy Carmichael, God got a hold of her heart and she started, somehow became aware of the suffering of people in India. And she left England and went to India, started a mission there, telling people about Jesus, rescuing children off of the trash heaps, saving little girls and sometimes little boys out of prostitution in the Hindu temples. A setting right of relationships, a healing of the world in the big things. But it's happening because God has gotten a hold of somebody's life and empowered them and shaped them to do something about those things. There's times that we've gotten this better and times that we've gotten it worse. But I think today in 2019 that pursuing justice through love has kind of lost some of its appeal to us in our culture today. In the last few years, the last few decades, we have too often seen people working out their grievances by shooting up crowds full of innocent people, by setting neighborhoods and towns on fire, by spitting at police officers and throwing poo at them, by driving cars into crowds of people. And just like in the little things, you'll never get justice. You'll never get the thing that you want. And this is everybody. I mean, political left, political right, middle, weird, fringe, everybody. There's representatives from everybody trying to advocate for their grievances through hate and through violence and through ugliness. And we're never going to get to the place that we want to go that way. That road will not lead the world that we want to live in. Close with sharing one example of a time that some of us, I think, got it right. And read a piece of Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail. In the spring of 1963, civil rights leaders were targeting their attention on Birmingham. It was one of the most segregated and oppressive, hate-filled cities in our nation. People were suffering. And civil rights leaders said, we are going to do something about this. We're going to figure out what we can. And I want to read this little excerpt to you because it shows you what their approach was. It wasn't just in this, but it was their approach in almost every town, every direct action thing that they took. This is what Dr. King says. In any nonviolent campaign, there are four basic steps. Collect the facts to determine whether injustice exists. Negotiation, self-purification, and direct action. We have gone through all these steps. He's writing this letter, by the way. He got locked up in jail when he went to Birmingham. And in a paper, some white ministers criticized him and said that he was kind of out of place and out of his geography to be doing these things. And he is writing this letter in response to them. We have all gone through all these steps in Birmingham. There can be no gainsaying the facts that racial injustice engulfs this community. Birmingham is probably the most thoroughly segregated city in the United States. Its ugly record of brutality is widely known. Negroes have experienced grossly unjust treatment in the courts. There have been more unsolved bombings of Negro homes and churches in Birmingham than in any other city in the nation. These are the hard, brutal facts of the case. On the basis of these conditions, Negro leaders have sought to negotiate with city fathers, figure out the facts, negotiate. But the latter consistently refused to engage in good faith negotiations. Then, last September, came the opportunity to talk to the leaders of Birmingham's economic community. In the course of the negotiations, certain promises were made by the merchants. For example, to remove the store's humiliating racial signs. On the basis of these promises, the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth and the leaders of the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights agreed to a moratorium on all demonstrations. As the weeks and the months went by, we realized that we were the victims of a broken promise. A few signs briefly removed, then returned, and others remained. As in so many past experiences, our hopes have been blasted and the shadow of deep disappointment settled upon us. We had no alternative except to prepare for direct action, whereby we would present our very bodies as a means of laying our case before the conscience of the local and national community, mindful of the difficulties involved. We decided to undertake a process of self-purification. We began a series of workshops on nonviolence, and we repeatedly asked ourselves, are you able to accept the blows without retaliating? Are you able to endure the ordeal of jail? What he is saying is their process was this, and what our process should probably likely be in the big things is figure out the facts. It's pretty easy to figure out the facts in Birmingham, but whatever the issue is that is burning in your life, that God puts in your heart, figuring out the facts may not always be so easy. There's a lot of lies in our world. Figuring out the facts may not always be so easy, but do the hard work there. Negotiate with the powers that be. Negotiate with those interested parties, and if direct action is needed, then spend time preparing your heart and what King calls self-purification. And so what they would do, and you can see in all the examples that you could, like, if you, there's not very many, like, modern examples of this. And you can see it in people, the way we respond. But they would spend days praying that God, their hearts would be right, encouraging each other to love their enemies. When they hit you, when they punch you, can you love them? When they hit the person standing beside you that you love, and it's your friend or your wife, or maybe even your kid that wants to stand beside you, can you love them? Can you take it? Can you hold yourself back from retaliating? As much hate as they pour on you, like Jesus on the cross, can you return that with love? Can you do it? And they would spend days and days praying, fasting, singing praises to God, trying to get their hearts right, to have the courage to love, the courage to love, the courage to love. And then they went out in Birmingham. They protested, they marched, they sang. They didn't throw things. They were beaten, they were attacked by dogs, they were blasted with water cannons. And it worked. The power of love worked. People saw it and they said, my gosh, not everybody, but enough saw it and said, we are on the wrong side of this thing. It is because of what they're doing, it is starkly clear to see what is good and what is right, who's on the right side of this and who's on the wrong side of this. My gosh, we're the wrong ones. You know, they couldn't see it before. They couldn't see it before. And there was enough of the oppressive group of people that said, I don't want any part of this anymore. And history changed. History changed. Jesus is trying to tell us, the civil rights movement is trying to tell us, that our motives matter when we are pursuing justice. If it's in love, we have a chance of getting there. If it's something else, if it's hate, if it's contempt, we're never going to make it. And I'm not saying that people weren't angry, that there aren't things worth being angry about. You betcha that they were angry. The whole reason that they were there because they were angry. Remember, anger cues you in that something is wrong and something isn't right. They came to Birmingham because they were angry. But they chose to address anger. They chose to address the injustice with love. And that's the call on your life, and that's the call on my life. To pursue justice in love. And in doing that, in your everyday life, and in the small things and in the big things, it's in those moments that you will be a true child of God. Let's pray.